Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of the Cult Popture Podcast was brought to you by our Patreon. If you want to tell us which films we should watch, get up to 2 extra exclusive podcasts a month, give us something to talk about in the post-credits scene at the end of each episode, or join us for our monthly Movie Club Zoom call where we discuss a film together, then please consider joining the cult and donating at www.patreon.com/cultpopture.
Hey, what's up everybody? Welcome along to the Cult Popture Podcast. This is a little intro section before the episode starts. This is, of course, our annual most disappointing films of the year. We did part one earlier in the year because we were like, let's split this up into each half of the year instead of doing them in 4 massive episodes by the end, or however it was that we did it. And so you would think that would mean that by and large our episodes would get shorter, we'd be more efficient at this, but it doesn't, and this is actually part 2 of 3. There are 3 most disappointing films episodes this year, in a year where nothing really came out, and of course by most disappointing we actually mean it's an episode that we talk about every movie that we saw this year and then crown the most disappointing midway through or during it. So because of that, the episode will end somewhat abruptly, but I'll be back at the end to do an outro and, of course, the post-credits scene. And also, this is also, well, both of these next 2 episodes will be very show notes heavy. If you go to the show notes below, you will see all the time codes for what we talk about and when we talk about it if you want to avoid spoilers. Although, from memory, we're only spoiler specific on certain movies that we usually signpost ahead of time. But, you know, whether you care or not, look in the show notes for that. And in the show notes, you will also find the letterboxed rankings for mine and Richard's top, you know, our rankings of 2020. So let's get to it. I hope you guys enjoy the episodes. And let us know what your most disappointing film of the year was. You can actually do that on our Discord. You can talk directly to us. There'll be a link to the Discord in the show notes. And everyone, more people should join the Discord. More people should join the Discord because you just get to chat with us and with all our friends and all our little community. So get on there. Let's have a discussion about 2020 in cinema. And we will see you next week for part 2. So I guess that Letterboxd ranking will be spoilers for how we ranked everything, but you could have also checked it at any time of the year. Anyway, let's get to the episode and I'll see you at the end. Do you want to start or should I start?
Hey, all you cool cats and kittens. Remember 2020? Hey, remember 2020? What a year. What a year.
God.
I'm desperately trying to remember a Tiger King reference, but it's actually been scrubbed from my mind from everything else that's happened. So,
yeah,
thanks, man.
Yeah, Tiger King is up there for the most disappointing things I watched in 2020. Could have been two episodes shorter. I'm sorry.
Do you know what, Richard? Could have not made it. I watched first episode and then gave up, so I liked it even less than you did.
And once again, AJ has proven that he's more woke than the rest of us.
That's right. Hi, and I'm Jeremy.
Why is that more woke? What does that have to do with anything?
I'm Richard.
And I'm AJ. And look,
this, I am more woke.
If you're worried that you have to remember 2020, don't worry. You actually only need to remember the last half of 2020. However, yeah, I understand that that might still be somewhat of a feat because each half of 2020 felt like its own year.
Decade. 9 halves of 2020.
So this is, of course, the Cult Popture Podcast, where we're bringing you our an annual tradition One that I enjoy more than Netflixmas, and that is our most disappointing films of the year rundown. This is, of course, part two. We did part one
rundown
in the middle of the year.
A bloody rundown at the end of 2020.
Hey, let's see how many more like redundant 2020 jokes we can make.
Redundant? Oh, yeah. Talk about all the people at my work that got made redundant.
Yikes.
Oh my god.
No, it's about entertainment, Richard, not about real life.
Entertainment, there's an industry that's bloody struggling.
Oh crap, no. I mean, it's about traveling outside of the norm.
Travel? Oh, no, okay.
No, it's about like sitting down, cracking open maybe a Corona and just really Alrighty, enough of this tomfoolery. We've actually got to get down to business, because the reason we split these podcasts up into multiple parts, one in the middle of the year, one at the end of the year, is because when we don't do that, we sit here till 4 a.m. It's currently 9:45, but if we don't split it up, we sit here until the early hours of the morning. Yeah. Talking about movies we kind of remember. each year, the goal has been to crown the most disappointing film of the year, and of course the only way to do that is to go through every single major release that came out in the year. This has always been our secret
content
farm wrap up.
Yeah.
And I think that I think it's probably still Doolittle, but there are
no, Doolittle's the worst film of the year. I don't know that's much. Yes.
What a portent for what was to come. Pulling bagpipes out of a dragon's ass.
Yeah, who would have thought that would be one of my highlights of the year, was seeing that in cinema.
When I reviewed that movie, I wrote at the end of it, 2020 is cursed, because I thought the movie was so bad, and I was right. Wow. So it was not my fault. It was Doolittle's fault. But yeah, so there will be, I probably have put a intro at the start of this episode, but in case I haven't, there will be in the show notes, you'll find time codes for each of the movies we talk about, because we will be dealing in spoilers for some, but not necessarily for all, depending on if it's a spoilable movie, if everyone in the podcast has seen the movie, because we respect, you know, not wanting to know spoilers.
And also, if AJ, if you don't put, you can cut this out, but if you don't put frames on the time codes, then it's much easier to skip through on YouTube, because you can just click on it. If it's just
I usually take frames off. Did I not take frames off?
Yeah, because I was trying to find a little bit that Jeremy and I made last year, which will reach its zenith.
You just turned this from a discussion about technical matters of the podcast to podcast content. So now AJ isn't going to be able to cut out that random chat because you talked about what's going to happen in the podcast.
People like it.
I know AJ well enough to know that if I go, oh, you can cut this out, it's staying. Whenever I want to make a really important point, I'll say, you can cut this out. And then I know that it's coming in.
I literally explode with paradox. I can't figure it out.
All right, so where we last left our heroes and at the start of July, we were talking about King of Staten Island was the most recent release. We were supposed to be looking forward to Top Gun Maverick and In the Heights, but COVID had other plans. Was supposed to actually come out earlier and to coincide with the contest it's named after, but Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, was released on Netflix at the start of July. I watched this film. Jeremy, did you watch this film?
Oh, yes, I did.
Okay, and AJ, you watched it as well?
Yes.
Ah,
what a great
a
start.
So I watched this movie.
So spoilers galore!
If you have any intention of watching Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, do not listen any further. So yeah, what did everyone think of this film? I really enjoyed it. I thought this was... I remember like when the trailer came out, I might have even said it on the mid-year one, but this looked so stupid. Like,
well, it didn't just look so stupid. For the first 15 minutes, I was just like, oh man, I think I was even messaging you guys when I was watching, because you had messaged me and said, oh my god, watch it, you have to watch it.
Because I messaged both of you, I was like, oh, this is actually pretty good. So AJ went and watched it, was like, pfft. And I was like, no, I want... I wasn't meeting you, AJ. I just want Jeremy to watch it.
And I was just like, I was messaging you and I was just like, Will Ferrell needs to stop. For the first 15 minutes of the movie, I was just like, he needs to stop making movies. He's not funny anymore. I can't stand this awful dreck. And then I'm pretty sure it was the moment when the boat that all the Iceland competitors were on exploded in the water. And they were watching. And she was like, oh, no. And he's like, oh, the elves. They've gone too far. Like, I fucking lost my shit laughing at that line. And from then on, I was just part of it. I was in the movie and I went with it and I had such a good time.
Yeah.
It was just a classic. And it made me realize how long it's been since I've actually watched just a stupid comedy that whole purpose for existing was to make me laugh. Yeah. And it did. And I loved it.
Yeah. AJ, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that, Richard, you started that with like, oh, the trailer looks so stupid. And Jeremy was like, oh, the first 15 minutes. And I was like, no, 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 gentlemen, it was stupid. And the whole movie was bad. I don't know where you're getting this breath of fresh air that everyone claimed this movie. And to be honest, though, I think this is one of those things where like the narrative was, you think it's going to be real bad, but it's actually really good. That's what I was told, went into it expecting that. It wasn't that, so it flipped back around to, no, it's actually just really bad. I watched this with a friend who doesn't watch a lot of movies, and I was like, this is supposed to be really good. We watched it, and by the end I was like, hey, man, I'm really sorry. it was awkward. It was so bad that it was an awkward time with my friend watching it. Do you know that, how old are you willing to believe Rachel McAdams? Or how old or young?
Yeah, this was the thing, because I watched this with my wife. Insert my wife's thing here.
That's too dated.
It's so, so dated. But I watched this with my wife. And
Borat will never be popular in 2020. Like,
such a dated reference. So she was watching it with me, and she just kept on saying every time there was anything romantic between Rachel McAdams and Will Ferrell, she was like, How are they expecting us to believe this? Like, how did anyone ever think it would be okay? But I'm like, for me, I'm like, that's part of the comedy.
Yeah, and it's also the fact that like they've known each other since when they were little kids, and I would believe that Will Ferrell's like 50 and Rachel McAdams is like 40.
But the thing
that's
is, that
that's not the actual ages.
Well, that's not what it is, though.
No,
they're
because
the same
when, they're
age.
Little, when they're little kids, they're like 3 or 4 years apart.
Okay,
max.
Well, maybe they're like 42 and 46.
And he's a real old 46. Yeah.
They shot themselves in the foot by making them childhood friends, I think. Because if they weren't that, it's just like they're whatever age they are.
Yeah.
But because they were shown to be kids together, it's like, listen, and no offense to Will Ferrell, you do not look any younger than 50 at the youngest. And Rachel McAdams, I could probably believe, as young as early 30s. Right. You know, but they certainly don't look the same age. And also to your wife's point, Jeremy, I think part of it as well is that the story for a lot of it is that Rachel McAdams has a crush on Will Ferrell, and it's not like a reciprocated thing for a long time.
But again, that is part of the comedy. Yes. I think. But like, so in defense of this film, because I loved it. I thought it was great.
The defense that 2/3 of this conversation is in favor of.
Well, yeah, but you guys are shitting on it. So, but like, I know I've spoken in the past about like against the idea of like a turn your brain off film. But like Jeremy said, it was like I was in the mood, and you know, it was fucking 2020. It was mid 2020. Sorry for wanting to laugh.
We'd come out of lockdown. We needed something.
Yeah, but like it was literally just a film I could put on, and once I gave myself over to it, and the whole thing of like the elves and Demi Lovato coming back from the dead to warn Will Ferrell that the bad guy's bad, which he's just found out, and he's like, "What a terrible ghost! What an unhelpful ghost!" AJ's laughing. But apart from anything else, I loved the music in this film. Like the Volcano Man, which is supposed to be like the silly bad song, is great. Double Trouble, the one that gets them into the top 10 for Eurovision. And then
Yaya Ding Dong.
Yaya Ding Dong and Húsavík, my hometown. Yeah. They're all fantastic songs. So, and that's one thing that like always gets me in a movie is like when they actually make the effort to make the music good. We spoke about this when we did Walk Hard for one of our Patreon podcasts. But it's like the music in that movie is so good, but the whole rest of the movie is so stupid. And it helps you give yourself over to it because there's a sincerity to it.
Yeah, what's really crazy about it is that, so every now and then, I think it's probably every like 4 years, I'm an occasional watcher of Eurovision. So about every 4 years, I just go, I'll check in on Eurovision this year because it's so ridiculous. And there's just something, literally just like this movie, Eurovision is batshit insane and it knows it and it doesn't care. Yeah. And it wants to deliver you more of the batshit insaneness. And so I watched last year's Eurovision, which is where they filmed Eurovision. The whole stadium and the whole setup with the stage and lighting rig and everything was what they had in last year's Eurovision. And it was just so immense and crazy. And there are like definable types of Eurovision song that come out in every competition. Mm. There's like the sort of cool one, there's the really kitschy one, there's the Nordic one, which is exactly what the
Húsavík.
Not Húsavík. It's the one that had maybe it is. Like, it's the one that had like the beautiful woman singing and then like a guy who goes, like the people who wrote the music for this movie understand what happens at Eurovision in such a perfect way. I was watching this being like, they have got the map of what songs come out of Eurovision every single time and they are nailing it. Like, genuinely, these could be real songs.
For Will Ferrell, because his wife is Scandinavian,
so right,
and so he would go over there, like he'd lived there for 6 months of the year, and he discovered the Eurovision Song Contest for like the last 10 years, and just fell in love with it, and essentially like, you know, has been trying to get this movie made for a long time, and when he took it to the director, he was like, "Can we change the name?" Like, because he'd never heard of it, you know, and like and yeah, because it's not something that's really made it across to the US. We get it here a little bit, just like, you know, we're getting every other country's leftovers. But
well, weirdly, Australia is massively into Eurovision. Yeah. So much so that they actually got invited to be part of the competition last year.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
which is like, there is a bit in this movie that's clearly for Eurovision fans, where it has what I can only assume is like some greats. Because I recognize Conchita Wurst.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like they go to a Eurovision party and there's what you can tell from context are like celebrity guests. But also we should move on so we don't spend there 2 hours talking about Eurovision. But Dan Stevens is fantastic in this film.
He's amazing.
Best part of the movie.
The last thing I'll say about this movie is that for people who've watched it, this is amazing because one of my friends, they got really into it. And
the movie or Eurovision?
The movie. Yeah. They got really into the movie. And so the wife was playing the soundtrack over and over again.
Yeah, yeah.
And their son, who is 3 years old, had never seen the movie. He'd only ever heard the songs. And my friend sent me a video of his son crying when there's a song from Eurovision playing.
Yeah.
And the little boy is going, "No, play Yaya Ding Dong. Play Yaya Ding Dong." Literally had never seen the movie, did not know that was a joke in the movie. He just genuinely wanted them to only play Yaya Ding Dong from the
This is also one of two films we'll cover featuring Graham Norton. But we'll come back to that. Now, the easiest way for me to kind of do it, because I'm using the same list that we did for Anticipated, so it's fun to look at what movies we thought we would have seen by now.
Oh, right.
And when they're going to be released. So Minions Rise of Gru was supposed to come out July 3rd, delayed to July 2nd, 2021. Free Guy was supposed to come out the same day, delayed to December 11th, now delayed again to May 21st. But we got a fun, exciting thing happened. What was supposed to come out next year was moved forward to July 3rd, Hamilton went straight to Disney Plus, supposed to receive a theatrical release next year. We all watched this. What was everyone's experience with the musical, the musical beforehand? Had anyone listened to it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Had you, AJ?
Yeah, I remember when it first came out, Jeremy, you played it to me in your car. We were hanging out.
Cute.
And you said you didn't like it and everyone loved it. It was this new musical. You said, have you heard of Hamilton? And for like 10 minutes of the conversation, I thought you were talking about the city, the New Zealand city. Unironically as well, because now, obviously not internationally, but nationally it's somewhat of a common joke now to, you know, make Hamilton jokes about Hamilton. But I genuinely for a while thought you were talking something about the city. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then you played
Have you heard of Hamilton? Everyone likes it, but I hate it. And you're like, everyone hates Hamilton.
You played me the song, and I was like, okay. And then I heard the song a bunch over the years, sort of vaguely grew to understand what the musical was about, but had never seen it, had never heard any other song in it.
Yeah, well, great lead in, AJ, because it's totally the truth, I have to admit. And I said it on the most anticipated that I really, really, really did not like Hamilton.
Well, why would you have said it on most anticipated? Because we didn't know it was coming out this year.
He said it on part one of most disappointed.
Did I not?
Jeremy planned COVID.
No. We knew in the most disappointing, sorry, most disappointing
I know,
part
I was just making a joke about you. Making COVID.
Yeah. But anyway, that basically, I was looking forward to watching it because I wanted to see what everyone was talking about. Yeah. And boy, howdy, did I see what everyone was talking about.
Good, yeah,
because holy, like, just, I think it's unfair to listen to the music by itself. And I know that many people had the experience of listening to the album and they loved it because they could really get with that kind of music. And I think in the Heights is a similar, because the other Lin-Manuel Miranda musical, similar experience, just very Lin-Manuel Miranda style of kind of the rapping and musical kind of mashed together. And I just didn't understand it. But man, watching it happen live on a stage with the energy and
being
the
in the room where it happened.
Yeah. But like the energy, the power, the quality of the performances, the acting, the vitality of like how much is going on stage at all times. I was completely blown away by this. I watched it 3 times over the course of this year. It is rocketed up to being one of my favorite musicals of all time. Complete turnaround.
It's similar to AJ. I'd heard the song Alexander Hamilton just because you couldn't avoid it for like a year. And then I had it on my like Spotify and I'd listened to it quite a bit, but I'd never listened to any other songs from it. And then when I found out that Disney was going to be releasing it, I was like, well, now I won't listen to it until I've seen it. And so essentially I treated it as like, I know I'm going to like the music from it, and watching it is like unlocking being able to do that. And then ever since then, like for the rest of the year, Wait For It was my most played song on Spotify last year. But it was, I mean, it's fantastic. And I hope it paves the way for filming more musicals like that as well.
Yeah.
Getting the original cast in, doing a couple in front of an audience, but then being able to really get up and close, and you can see just how carried by the rest of the actors Lin-Manuel Miranda is. I mean, like he's incredibly, incredibly talented man. And the fact that this entire thing came from one person's brain is such a foreign concept. Like that's so bewildering to me. But
now
yes,
I get why
Leslie Odom Jr. did deserve the Tony over him.
Totally. And also I now understand why at a certain point we all started seeing David Diggs everywhere, because talent scouts saw him do that on stage and said, we need him.
Yeah.
We need him.
And he's another one that pops up later on in the year as well. Same movie with Graham Norton, actually. AJ?
So yeah, I've been seeing a lot of they must be like Facebook ads or YouTube ads where there's two clips that stick in my mind and they're about Hamilton. And one of them is Jimmy Fallon. Is it Fallon or Kimmel?
Probably Fallon.
He's talking to Questlove. Which one's that?
That's Fallon.
Fallon.
Unless for some reason Jimmy Kimmel is on the Tonight Show set
Jimmy
talking
Fallon
to Questlove.
And it's like a clip from like a 2016 episode of the Tonight Show. And he goes like, Questlove, how amazing is this musical? And Questlove's like, oh, it's life-changing. And I was like, man, that's so sincere, but I agree.
And also, and Questlove also appears in that film with David Diggs and Graham Norton.
And there's another clip of a guy going like, I have more than once compared Lin to Shakespeare, and I do it without embarrassment. And I get it, that as well. Like you said, it's bewildering to think that all of this came from the mind of one person. It seems it seems impossible almost that one guy could spearhead this. Like, watching this for the first time, obviously like viscerally really liked it, but I was still like, is this the best thing I've seen this year? And I sort of, it was one of those things where I didn't stop thinking about it.
But it also kind of feels like cheating as well to put it as number one.
Yeah, 100%.
Because I just put it as number one and left it all year. Didn't even think about dethroning it. But it's like, it feels like cheating because it's not like, I'm not like, oh my God, the movie was amazing. It's just like, well, Hamilton's incredible.
Well, exactly. You know? And also like, it's, you credit the performers with doing it live on stage. It's a completely different art form. And just, I guess, because it was released, you know, as a feature length kind of, you know, thing for you to watch on a TV screen, it sort of puts it in that film category. But I think that, you know, like the discipline of creating a musical is just so much. I think that the bones of the creation of it are very much more visible on the stage than it is when you're watching a film, where all that sort of stuff is kind of, the whole artifice of film is that all of that is hidden. And so I think that the just watching Hamilton is much more impressive out the front there because you're seeing it all being made in front of you.
I think, like, I watched it again with my family, because they were keen to see it, and it's actually so beautiful, and so, like, the themes of it are so interesting, that the messages being communicated are some of the most interesting ideas I've ever seen communicated in a story before. I think Aaron Burr, that's Leslie Odom Jr., right?
Yeah.
He's so amazing. The character of Aaron Burr was such a human, flawed character that, and I related to him so much more than Hamilton, because he's cautious and he's self-loathing and foolish and has all these regrets. And the song, I think it's Wait for It, where he says, what is the line?
If there's a reason I'm still alive when everyone who loves me has died, I'm willing to wait for it.
Fucking hell.
Yeah.
What the fuck? That is one of the most human ideas I've ever heard expressed. That I relate to that a lot, and like, talking about it, I get a little bit choked up thinking about that concept, right? Yeah. Because that's such a crippling moral, like, philosophy to maintain. Like, it's mind-blowing. So I loved his character. I loved King George, thought he was pretty funny, Jonathan Groff.
I will say just about Wait for It, there's a show on Netflix called Song Exploder. It's based on a podcast, and it's this guy interviewing different artists about how they came up with one song. So there's like an REM one about Losing My Religion, there's one with The Killers about When You Were Young, but he does one with Lin-Manuel Miranda, and it's about Wait for It, and like Lin says, it's probably the best song I'll ever write. And but talking about, because you also hear like a lot of his demos, because he's like, he talks about like he like left a party early because he was like on his way to a party and he had inspiration. So he's just like pulling out his phone and like rapping into his phone while walking along, and they play you that recording of him like freestyling the song essentially. But he talks about how, because I think he relates a lot more to Hamilton, and the way that they create the two characters of Hamilton and Aaron Burr, they have such diametrically opposed viewpoints, but neither one is really wrong, because Hamilton is all about, I'm not throwing away my shot, and obviously Aaron Burr's like, I'm willing to wait for it. But he talks about the hardest part about writing this song was like, well, how do I dramatize waiting? Because it's not an inherently theatrical thing to do, whereas it's very easy to be like, you know, I'm not throwing away my shot, I'm just like my country, I'm young, scrappy and hungry. But it's like, how do you make waiting sound cool? But it's like, fuck, he did it with this is a fucking incredible song.
It made it like profound and existential. Yeah. And yeah, look, I think it's one of the best things I've ever seen, and will think about it for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
To be like, not to be over dramatic, but like, that I really just was so gradually moved by it. Like, initially it didn't hit me, it more just stayed with me, and I was like, shit man, I can't stop thinking about this thing.
All right, so a week later we were supposed to see Ghostbusters Afterlife. Remember that?
Oh my god,
remember that they're making another Ghostbusters coming out in March next year. Greyhound went straight to Apple TV Plus. Did you watch this, Jeremy?
Absolutely not.
Oh yeah, Okay, well, you were excited for it.
But my parents did. My parents watched it.
Yeah, did they like it?
They loved it.
Oh, yeah. So, well, check it out.
Everyone's parents watched it and loved it.
Yeah. Palm Springs, this was kind of, this is the hot movie of 2020 that everyone's talking about. I remember this being, in January, it was like the most expensive purchase at a film festival.
Well, there was a bidding war for it, yeah. Right?
And it won by 69 cents. They played like $15 million and 69 cents for it, or something like that. But yeah, so this is the Andy Samberg and Krista Milioti time loop film, and coming out in the middle of a pandemic where every day starts to feel the same, I think a lot of people gravitated towards a time loop film. Yeah, if I'd known it was coming out this year, it would have been my most anticipated. But yeah, I really enjoyed this film. It's a very, very nice watch. AJ, what did you think of it?
I liked it. I was kind of, my expectations were set quite high.
Yeah.
And I don't think it eclipsed my expectations, unfortunately, which is such a sucky reason to like be down bad on a movie. Mm. But that is sort of what happened, was that I had it built up to me. I built it up to my bubble that I watched it with.
Yeah.
And then it ended up being like pretty good.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, it's just a really decent movie. It's just a nice movie, and it's cool. And like, I did really enjoy it. But yeah, I was looking forward to this like all year. And I knew a lot about it, but then I think a lot of people had the fortune of stumbling upon it, because that's kind of how everyone describes it, as like this unexpected movie that dropped in the middle of the year and it turned everyone's lives around. And it's like, yeah, no, it was just a movie that I was looking forward to, and then it satisfied my cravings for Palm Springs.
Did you see it, Jeremy?
I literally have no recollection of anyone talking about this movie at all. So, oh. No, I didn't.
Well, you should check it out. I think you'll like it. All right. It is a very good movie.
It's one of those movies, though, where I think it's a lot more graphically, like sexually graphic than I think people would necessarily expect. Certainly more than I was expecting. And
Sign me up!
Hey! I'm busted to see Andy Samberg. Fuck.
Because you never know, right? When it's a comedy, you never know how raunchy it's going to be. And I sort of
and then they say, you know, come after what? How many minutes?
I watched it, and one of our new flatmates had just moved in. This was actually after lockdown ended. So, yeah. A new flatmate moved in, and I built up this movie, and it like starts with a jerking off scene. I immediately broke into cold sweats, being like, "Oh, is my new flatmate cool enough?
Oh my god,
to
what if my new flatmate doesn't jerk off?
What if he doesn't know what's going on?"
I think you're safe to assume that no matter who your new flatmate is, they masturbate.
Okay, well, I'll ask her. But the
everyone the, does. Everyone I guess, does.
I was fortunate to have watched it with my flat, because this could have very, very easily been hanging out with my parents one night. Hey, shall we watch a movie? Oh yeah, I heard this one's really good. Mm. Like this could very easily be a watch with your parents movie, and it very much isn't that.
Yeah. I'm very glad for you, AJ. That's a near miss.
Legit though, it actually was.
So another big movie of the year, possibly the biggest movie of the year,
a tentpole movie.
Tenet. So this was supposed to come out July 17th, was delayed 2 weeks because like, oh well, the pandemic will be done by the 31st of July, and then it wasn't. So they were like, okay, we'll push it to August 12th, and then it got pushed again to the end of August, and they're like, fuck it, we're just releasing it. And so this was actually released. New Zealand had a second lockdown in August, just in Auckland. So AJ got to see this like a week before I did. And you know what? And then even when cinemas opened again, I was like, I actually don't really care that much about seeing it. because, God, boy, the wind been taken out of my sails in that week. It kind of just like, this is such an interesting film, and it's such a, it's, because this was, I guess, supposed to be the, are people ready to go back to cinemas? Christopher Nolan was saying they are. Apparently, well, there's now arguments about who was pushing for it and whatnot. And
do you know what I reckon?
What?
I reckon the studios or whoever's saying Like, I reckon studios are basically saying, we can take people not liking us, but Christopher Nolan is a product of ours, and we need people to be on his side. So I wouldn't be surprised if studios were taking the, like, falling on the sword and being like, no, we'll preserve you as a figure in film, Twitter, pop culture, while people hate us. Because they'll still see, like, I'll still see a Warner Bros. Movie if it's a director I like, you know? But I think they want to preserve his name.
You've soured on Christopher Nolan a bit now?
Well, I mean, the souring of Christopher Nolan has been a gradual experience over the past 6 or 7 years, but not this fast. I soured on him a lot quicker this year. I'm not completely soured. Like, I still... I genuinely don't think, though,
that one director could have that much influence over...
No, if any director does, it's like... It's Christopher Nolan, like, trying to keep, oh my God, like, the amount of critical and, like, audience praise and box office success he has, and he's, like, specifically partnered with Warner Brothers.
And also, I guess he is Legendary Pictures as well, so,
he is kind of a sort of money studio kind of thing himself.
I'd agree if you said that about anyone else, I think, Jeremy, but Nolan might actually
He's Spielberg level, the most,
Yeah, but also the fact that he's, like, exclusively Warner Brothers. But yeah, so now to the actual film, Tenet. This was so interesting because it's like, I remember when the trailer first came out, we might have talked about it in our most anticipated, but I was like, this looks like a parody of a Christopher Nolan film. Like, something about it just didn't excite me. It was very, like, I don't know, there was something lazy about it, about the idea of it and about... like, just how mysterious they were trying to be around it. And then the film came out, it kind of just had that same feeling. It was like, this is someone trying to do Christopher Nolan.
Well, yeah, I had a similar feeling in that when, like, I very much enjoyed the experience of being in the movie.
So did I. And after being told it was bad, I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, and then as soon as the movie finished... I just genuinely haven't spent much time thinking about it at all, because I think it's all head and no heart. Like, there's a real... I didn't emotionally connect with a single character in that whole movie.
Yeah.
Whereas there's movies like The Prestige and even Interstellar. Like, I actually really loved Interstellar. I loved the father-daughter storyline in that. I really, like, I felt... Mm. There were moments where I felt things that the characters were feeling. And in this movie, everything was so perfectly polished and hard-edged, and it's like Christopher Nolan had, like, made everything to perfection in his mind so that you couldn't kind of, like, argue with it at all. Like, it was just all his own Nolanishness.
I actually think that, like, you say all head, no heart. I don't know if Nolan can do both at the same time. I think a lot of his movies are all head. I think Inception's a great example of a film that's all head, but the difference is that Inception stars someone like Leonardo DiCaprio, who's very heart, right? So it balances out. I'd say the same with The Dark Knight is a very heady film, but it's so packed full of emotionally powerful actors. And I wonder if Tenet, and Interstellar is all heart. He's doing all heart and no head with Interstellar, I think.
Which is why so many people didn't like Interstellar, because it just made no sense.
And I think Tenet is all head, and none of the all the actors are also all head, you know? So I felt very ripped off with my experience with this movie, guys, because when the trailer comes out, Richard and I, we talk to each other every day of the year, right? We're always messaging each other.
We are.
And the trailer comes out and Richard's like, this looks bad. And I'm like, nah, man, you can't, it's Christopher Nolan. Like you go through an evolution as a straight white male film fan, right? Where you go from, like...
Is it the five stages of grief?
No. But it's like, you with Nolan, you start out, he's your first favorite director. You think he's God's gift to cinema. And then you grow up a bit and you're like, some of his stuff is legitimately some of the best cinema of our lifetime, but he's a little, he's not as smart as he thinks he is. You know,
he makes the Big Bang Theory. It's like movies for dumb people to feel smart, because they go, oh my God, I've heard of Star Trek. He just said the word Star Trek. Fuck him. I'm such a nerd. And it's like, Well, the plot's complicated because Elliot Page's character kept on asking questions. But then I was asking the same questions. So I'm just as smart as the film.
Sure. So my combating to Richard saying it looked bad was like, listen, I know we're a little bit too cool for Nolan at our age, but I think this could still be great. I was very excited for John David Washington. I was very excited for Robert Pattinson. And I know this didn't happen to everyone, what I'm about to say. And
you got COVID.
I know
I pooped
that
my pants at the cinema.
I got COVID watching Tenet.
I'm wondering if this is legitimately like a cilantro tastes like soap kind of thing, where some people have it, some people don't. I could not understand 75% of the dialogue.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that was kind of the big thing about it. And like, while Jeremy and I kind of both said, like, I didn't think about this, you know, after I finished watching it. I kept on getting Twitter notifications from Cop Pop Twitter that people liking AJ's tweets about for weeks about the sound mix. But because the thing was, I knew for like 2 weeks before I saw it, because I saw it late, that everyone was like, the sound mix is unbearable in this film.
Yeah.
Like, you cannot understand a single word of dialogue. And Christopher Nolan came out and said, oh, audiences only need to hear the gist of the dialogue. And then we did a podcast where I hadn't seen Tenet, but AJ and Rowan had. And I joined along in making fun of his quote. But then I watched the film and I was like, yeah, I got the gist of the dialogue, and that was enough. Like,
totally. this is why I'm saying I felt ripped off, because I was almost gaslighted into being the one who will represent the pro Tenet. So, you know, I knew at the end of the year when we do part two of Most Disappointing, I will be the representative for Tenet is good, actually, and Richard will be the one that goes, I was right, it was bad, I said it would be bad, and it completely flipped, and I felt so shortchanged by destiny, right? because as well, like, ethically, Richard, I know you disagree with Nolan and you disagree with this movie coming out and all these things that, like, and it sort of felt like together we were going to build up this, like, great crusade of Tenet being a really bad thing that happened. And then despite all that, you're like, I thought it was all right. And I was like, no, like, I don't know what to say now.
You were the chosen one. You were supposed to restore order to Nolan, not destroy him.
the audio mix conversation has many different people talking about it and many different perspectives on it. I legitimately think it could be a situation of the speakers in your cinema were better than the speakers in mine. But that being said, I did see this with Rowan, who later said that he understood a lot more of the dialogue than I did. But the point being, and it's also like other people saying, oh, it's too loud and that's why you can't hear it. And maybe that's part of it, but I think a big issue as well is the actors aren't articulating their lines. If say a line of dialogue from Robert Pattinson is, the line is like, I'm going to shoot a gun and the bullet is going to come back into the gun. Right? He doesn't say it like that. He goes, I'm going to shoot the gun and the bullet is coming back into the gun. And it's like, what? I heard four words. And
then John David Washington's like,
about midway through the film.
And then Kenneth Branagh's like, I'm on a yacht. You can't hear a thing.
About halfway through the film, it cuts to Kenneth Branagh, Elizabeth Debicki, and John David Washington on a yacht with masks on,
like,
talking to each other via walkie-talkie.
Hydrofoiling catamarans.
Yeah. And so the whole movie, I'm already, just without anything covering their faces, struggling to make out what they're actually saying. And then they go to a yacht with masks on, speaking through garbled radio, and I almost, like, audibly went, oh, fuck you, Nolan. Like, it's like he's it's like he's making fun of me. It's, you know, it's like he goes from like, it's like, because this started, let's be honest, this started years ago with The Dark Knight Rises, you know? Bane, you couldn't, like, famously had to be re-recorded because no one could understand
him. Anyway.
remixed, and in the actual movie, it's still pretty hard to understand it, right? And when I saw The Dark Knight Rises, I assumed it was a me problem. I assumed, you know, obviously one of the greatest working directors isn't going to fuck up something you learn in film school on day one, which is audio is more important than video. And so I was like, it's probably a me problem. And then Interstellar came out, and it's the same problem. And Michael Caine is delivering the twist of the film, and I can't hear what he's saying. Mm. And it's like, okay.
I can't even hear the gist.
I genuinely want you to do a YouTube video where you like break up with Christopher Nolan and you deliver the line, Chris, I've realized it's not me. It's the fact that you hate ADR.
Yeah, maybe. And then
you just
then
have
Dunkirk
to go with live sound. You can't re-record.
Then Dunkirk comes out, and like in with the benefit of hindsight, I would say the inaudible dialogue in Dunkirk is the platonic ideal of what he's actually claiming he's doing.
Dunkirk is and I've said this a few times, but like after Dark Knight Rises, we were like, okay, we know what Christopher Nolan is. Let's see his next big original thing. And then he split off into two. And all of the bad Christopher Nolan trope, the bad Christopher Nolan made Interstellar and the good one made Dunkirk. And then I think Tenet is the second one from the Interstellar Christopher Nolan. It's like, yeah, like you take all the...
It's like the one for you, one for me director studio relationship.
Yeah, but it is... but because Dunkirk is like, yeah, it's the perfect idea of... All right, well, he's kind of all style, no substance. So let's make a film where substance doesn't really matter. There's not much dialogue in it anyway. You do actually just get the gist.
It's an experience.
Yeah, like Tom Hardy is like, yeah, you might not be able to super understand it, but you know, okay, like he taps his fuel gauge. Okay, he must be talking about how he's almost out of fuel.
You get the desperation.
Yeah. And that's kind of like, you could watch Dunkirk silent, like with the sound off, yes, and you would follow the story.
Yes, and what's crazy about that is that it implies Nolan's aware of this, whereas Tenet implies he's completely unaware of it, right?
Yeah, like Dunkirk felt like a response to Interstellar.
Well, no, but like, sure. You watch Tenet, and it's almost like you get the feeling that Christopher Nolan's been, like, trawling the Reddit threads, and then he's just like, you know what, Reddit? Fuck you. Here you go. Here's something to talk about.
I'm going to make you risk your fucking life to watch this movie.
And so we actually did a collab with Centero, the YouTube channel, for a video over on Centero's channel. It's called like The Problem with Christopher Nolan Sound Mix or something. And I'm in it basically going ham, basically saying like Dunkirk is kind of genius, right? Dunkirk is like almost a smart ass response to people saying they couldn't understand Interstellar, right? And it works. And that's what's so great about it is that this fuck you to critics of Interstellar is actually a better film than Interstellar and possibly Nolan's finest work, I'll say it. But then right. With Tenet, it's like so the argument is boils down to, in the text of the film, it makes sense that you can't hear anything in Dunkirk, and the film is designed so that you don't actually have to understand what people are saying in Dunkirk. But Tenet, man, is so... It's about something. It is about a very specific set of rules that are communicated to you, the audience member. It is so story-based and so dialogue-based, and it's a film that demands you pay attention to what is happening in the story.
Like all the dialogue is just exposition.
Exactly. Also, the difference between Dunkirk and Tenet is that Dunkirk is an elevator pitch, right? Yeah. Like, you can tell someone, like, the trailer promises you, hey, all these men need to get home, but will they get help before the enemy arrives to kill them all?
Including Harry Styles.
And Tenet is like, okay, so this absolute paradox that could never happen is happening in some way. We have no idea why, and we have no idea how. But if we don't understand it, the world is going to end as we know it. But we don't know how it would end. We also don't know how it would be fixed. But let these characters explain it to you as they do it.
Yeah.
And here's them explaining. Do you guys
know about how, we'll wrap up on Tenet, but you know how roosters have like a thing that goes...
Really looking forward to this.
A thing like that shuts the air canals when they do their crow. Oh, yes. Because it's so loud, you know, shattered eardrums. Do you think AJ's ears do that during a heist film and that's what happened?
Here's my final word on Tenet. It is a real shame that our entire conversation on Tenet has been about a technical aspect and not about the story or what happens in it or the acting or any of the things that I love Nolan films for. And I feel very kicked out of the clubhouse that Nolan has committed to this philosophy on sound design, because The Dark Knight is one of my favorite movies of all time. I think Inception, what a film. It might be the defining film of that generation, and we can all understand those films, and he's not excluding anyone. And now four films in a row, he's made movies where he seems to want to make it sound like all the dialogue is underwater. And it's such, I feel so... Yeah, I feel kicked out of the clubhouse, and I feel like I can't enjoy them anymore unless he changes. And he should change, because he came out and said that other directors have asked him to change. It is important. Dialogue is, in my opinion, dialogue, unless under very specific circumstances, should be crystal clear, beyond realistic. Yeah. You know, I'm not looking for realistic dialogue. I would rather hear exactly what someone's saying than have like be like, well, you know, there was a loud truck next to them, so of course you wouldn't be able to. I don't want that. I want to be given that. You know, I want to be able to understand.
It's the same way that you enjoy having a soundtrack behind what's going on.
Precisely.
Also, final word on this is just fuck you, Christopher Nolan, you egotistical prick. If you're so concerned about the fucking theatrical experience, you should have been the first film to delay yourself and wait until it's safe. It's actually fucking disgusting that you would do this. You make me sick. Yeah.
And since you guys have had final words, my final word on Tenet would be, imagine Michelle Williams instead of Elizabeth Debicki. I think that would have been...
I really like Elizabeth Debicki.
I like her, but I think that she was she's too tall. I think that she was part of what made the film too kind of hard and polished and shiny.
I think that's also just a Nolan writing woman problem, though.
Sure, yeah. But I think that Michelle Williams could have gotten around it.
The one line of dialogue I actually heard in the film was like when they're like, the big bad will kill everyone in the whole world. And she goes, including my son. And it's like, actually, yes. This is the one line I've heard.
Yeah.
The my son memes that came out of that.
I cracked up in the theater and that.
So I would say this is probably my most disappointing of the year.
Pretty fair. My most disappointing is Christopher Nolan as a human being. The lack of respect he showed for his fans by releasing Tenet. I mean, I get that it's like, you want to give them what you want, but my God, like, wait till it's safe.
I mean, we all still went and saw it, though.
Yeah.
This is Nolan's first truly bad movie, in my opinion.
Mm. All right, Bob's Burgers did not come out, coming out April next year. Jungle Cruise, we're very excited for July 30th next year.
Jungle Cruise could easily be good.
Jungle Cruise will be next year's Tenet. I'm calling it now. Premium VOD. I hope you guys had $40 spare so you could buy Mulan plus a Disney Plus subscription. So Mulan came out. It was interesting around this time when they were like, okay, well, we need people to watch movies. How can we do it? Warner Brothers was like, well, let's just put movies in theaters, see if people come. And then they didn't release accurate stats for the film. They said their opening weekend was a certain amount, but that actually included the entire week beforehand and in Canada as well, not just the US. But made so much money opening weekend. But the fact that they haven't had any other big releases and they've actually got another plan for next year shows it probably didn't work. Mulan was Disney's way of trying that to see, will people pay a premium price, $40 in New Zealand, $30 in the US, to get access to like a brand new film. I think there's a world in which this could work. If they'd been able to release it in countries where it was safe to release things, that could have been fine. If it was, you could pay $30 instead of getting Disney Plus, and it was maybe $10 if you had it, or something like that, I would have been willing to get on board with it. But
or if
the
it
fact
wasn't
they did
Mulan.
This, yeah, the fact they did this the shady business practice with what a fucking terrible film. My God, did you watch it, Jeremy?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, so
they
bad.
Didn't do it with Hamilton. But imagine if they did this with Hamilton. No one would even be complaining if they did this with Hamilton.
I would have gladly paid that for Hamilton.
I also, let the record show, I didn't pay for Mulan. I knew people who worked on it who had a password that they shared around.
I flagrantly just pirated it to watch it. But like, imagine if they did this with Hamilton. Hamilton is so good that we wouldn't have even realized the ethical quandaries involved in this production
I would
have
been
model.
Thanking them. I would have been thanking them for making me pay $30, $40.
But so anyway, Mulan, it's a retelling of the 90s Disney film.
Without all the fun.
Without all the fun, out of the songs, no Mushu. And you know what? Yeah, I don't even really know Mulan that well. I didn't care they took out Mushu. If China were offended by it, then yeah, whatever, it should be taken out. Like, it's stupid. Or maybe it isn't. I don't know. I don't really care. But this film, it's like, I understand the original is about, like, you know, this woman who uses her like wits and her courage to overcome everything. And this one, it's about a girl who happens to have magic powers and is just magically stronger than all the men. And it, like, yeah, it's so lazy. And it's like, this isn't what people want. This isn't like why people, this isn't feminism.
It is astonishingly bad at being feminist. There's a great video I'll recommend by Accented Cinema, who basically goes over how Mulan 2020 is just a complete failure of feminism. And on top of that, it also kind of looks shit. There's some pretty wonky CGI in it.
Oh, and the wire work is awful.
I did know one of the, we talked about this, I'm sure I knew one of the actors in it, and all in the entire promotional lead up to Mulan, I'm sure I've said it on the podcast, like, oh my god, I wish I stayed in contact with this person, we could have got an exclusive interview for the show. Now I'm kind of glad that didn't happen, because I would have to be like, hey man, this is your big break. And I thought it was not only a bad movie, but an offensive movie and shouldn't have been made.
You should be ashamed.
Which is a bummer, because this was hyped up to be Disney's best live action remake yet, you know?
Because they're taking it seriously. They're getting rid of
Got a woman director, so it's going to be feminist.
And in retrospect, I do kind of almost feel like it's one of the lesser ones, ultimately. Like, and I think it has
it might be the worst.
It has a higher Rotten Tomato score, I think, than like Lion King and stuff. But yeah, in retrospect, I feel like it's way more of a blow than the other ones, I guess.
Like, this is actually, like you say, it's not only bad, it's actually offensive. And it's just, it's very, like, because also the fact that there was, like, no one Chinese involved in it, and it's like, you know, it was directed by a white woman. The production designers were all white, and it's like, this is such a missed opportunity. Mm. Like, why would you not get... It feels like a boardroom of middle-aged white men being like, okay, well, how do we write a feminist film? Okay, well, what if she's strong? It's like, okay, sweet. And also, like, in this
she can't be strong as a man, as a woman. So let's make her a magic woman.
And also the whole thing of, like, so she ties her hair up, and then the big dramatic reveal is that when she takes her hair down, and they're like, oh my god, it's a woman, and it's like, you all have long hair. That's what it would all look like if any of you took your hair down. But it's like, no, only a woman would take their hair out.
It's the equivalent of, like, the glasses being taken off to reveal the art nerd was always a hot girl.
That actually comes up later on in this podcast as well.
And look, that would be fine. That's exactly what it is in the cartoon as well. But in a cartoon, you're already one layer of reality removed, so you can believe that the characters in the world of the film see things a different way. It's a lot more confronting when it's live action. And the funniest thing about this film is that it gives the hawk from the original film a tragic backstory where it turns out they're actually a witch that has transformed into a hawk. Very funny
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, but
very
she's also cool. a girl, and so her and Mulan feel a sense of kinship.
Yeah, exactly. So this
is one of those films where it's like, it feels like, oh, of course they're going to shit on the female lead Disney movie with a female director, but it's like, no, it's not doing these things well enough.
Which is something we've done before. And I'd also like to point out, though, that I was one of the only one of us who liked Birds of Prey. So I've still got enough feminist points to
Birds of Prey is like
so uncomfortable right now.
Birds of Prey, at the end of the year, people are saying that Birds of Prey was like one of the top films of the year. And it's like, to me, it's a taking crazy pills thing.
I'd put it 16th, which I think is fair. Not my top 10, but it's still better than, let's see here. SpongeBob the movie. that's one of the films I think it's better than.
Well, no spoilers for the rest of the podcast, but just after this we got An American Pickle, which we didn't watch, but AJ, did you want to quickly give your thoughts on that?
It is a fine, okay movie.
What's it about?
It's about Seth Rogen as a modern day man. But 100 years ago, his grandfather, who's also, or his great-great-grandfather, who's also played by Seth Rogen, left Russia to come to America and work in a pickle factory, where he fell in a big barrel of brine by accident, and then the pickle factory closed down, and they left him in the brine, and 100 years later, he wakes up. And he's like, I am Seth Rogen from 100 years ago. And him and Seth Rogen from 2020 team up. And it's all right. I mean, it comments a bit on cancel culture in a really funny way.
Oh.
Because he's like a 100-year-old man. And he gets, they have like a falling out midway through the movie. And the pickle man, the 100-year-old, the grandfather, gets really, it becomes like a viral pickle salesman on the streets of New York, and it's really like kitsch. Like, he sells using recycled jars, and he collects the water with it's rainwater and stuff like that. Mm. And so it's like a big fad for like kitsch New Yorkers. And then it obviously comes out that he's like horrifically sexist and homophobic and racist, which is really funny because that's so true. And it comments on cancel culture in a way that's not like the way that Generation X is commenting on it, which makes you roll your eyes because, you know, it's not like, oh, you can't say anything these days. It's like, no, you can't say anything these days. And that's a good thing, you know?
Yeah,
right. So it tackles it better than, like, say, Todd Phillips tackled it when talking about Joker.
Listening
last year
to you describe the plot of that movie, I'm like, how the hell did that get financial backing?
I think it's an Amazon Prime film.
HBO Max.
Or HBO Max.
But and also
it's
was
pretty
like,
low budget. It's not very.
Yeah,
not very,
and it, but yeah. It said the old Seth Rogen has a big beard and the new one doesn't. And that it's actually a beard that he shaved and then shot the other half of the film.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Which is pretty impressive. Yeah. All right. Personal History of David Copperfield. I think this came out.
It did.
Did you watch it?
It did come out. I didn't get a chance.
Jeremy,
to watch it.
I feel like I've heard you talk about this movie for 6 years.
I know. I'm like I have this movie ready to go, and I just know that it's a movie that my wife will really enjoy, and so I've been waiting for an opportunity for us to watch it together, and I have not.
You haven't watched it?
I haven't watched it. God. I'm sorry. It looks so good, and all the reviews are amazing. So I'm looking forward to it in 2021.
Bill and Ted Face the Music. This is another one that's like, this has been, you know, it's crazy to think this actually came out. But this was a video on demand release. I think it had a limited theatrical release as well. By all accounts, it was pretty good. Or like, yeah, not actually that bad. That was kind of the review I heard.
I think it was like such low expectations of a reanimation of the Bill and Ted idea.
And also just like, you know, there is, it gets a little bit of leeway for being one of the only films to release this year. But I've never seen any of the Bill and Ted films. So I would have seen it had I seen them, but you know. No.
Well, I'll say this is that it'll be a film franchise, Fortnite's episode one day.
Yeah.
So none of us ended up seeing it, but we will talk about it on Cult Popture canon.
At some but in August, the first hour of this podcast, we went through 1 month, and now in the following 2 minutes, we're already through another month because the New Mutants came out at the end of August. This finally came out.
What a moment for all of us. We can all go home now.
Yeah. Turn off the podcast.
This has been, like, I know this has been every podcast, movie podcast's inside joke. We're not claiming to be the podcast that makes jokes about New Mutants getting delayed all the time. But it did become somewhat special for us, specifically because we do this every year, and this has been supposed to have come out every year for the past 4 or 5 episodes of Most Disappointing. We did cover this in our Patreon podcast, so I probably won't talk about it to the same extent that I talked about it on there. You're gonna have to pay $5, baby, to get that. But suffice to say, it's not very good. It's maybe one of the worst films a 20-year franchise could end on. There's a lot wrong with it and not a lot right with it. I'd made a video about this for the One Excellent Scene playlist, talking about how, sure, it doesn't look that great, but it's cool that the X-Men superhero cinematic universe was trying out other genres. You know, they could have made this much more of a horror than it actually was.
Yeah, that was kind of the main my main takeaway from it, is that, like, for as bold as the trailer kind of the stance it took, it was a very tame movie. Like, the bit I remember in the trailer that made me think, like, oh my god, I might actually even watch this movie because I'll be too scared, is when one of the main characters like looks into a dryer and the thing fills with flames, and it's a jump scare. And in the actual movie, there's a cut between when he looks in and when it fills with flames, so it makes it not a jump scare. Because, like, the scene builds so that him looking into a dryer filled with flames makes sense. Like, there's a whole scene in between it. And it's just shit like that. That's so bizarre. And it's because the director of it did The Fault in Our Stars, was his biggest movie. And it's like, why are you not getting a horror director to do this? Because, like, horror.
It's not like you're spoiled for choice. Almost every director in the world started out doing horrors. So
yeah, like every big blockbuster director these days started with horror. So when you're actually making a horror blockbuster, why would you get the guy who did The Fault in Our Stars?
Did you see it, Jeremy?
No, absolutely not. You guys warned me off of it.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than 1 billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, good.
Oh, well. X-Men's over now. Everybody pack up and go home. Which is the best testament to how much of a drop in the water this movie was, is that when Dark Phoenix came out, that was celebrated as the final movie in the X-Men saga, even though everyone knew New Mutants was still to come out. And then when New Mutants did come out, it was not celebrated as the final movie in the X-Men saga.
Yeah.
No one really talked about it. And this was also one of those things where, like, was this a, like, this was a unethical release as well, wasn't it? There was a big boycott in sort of our YouTuber circles because lot of the filmy guys didn't want to go see it because it came out just at one of the, I was going to say, the high points of COVID outbreaks in America. I'm sure it's not now.
Oh, it looks like it's peanuts compared to the numbers they're getting now.
But at the time, it was like, you shouldn't go see this. So a lot of YouTubers,
it was like, oh my god, hundreds of people are dying a day. And it's like, yeah, I mean, I wish things were that good again.
And so a lot of people would refuse to make, like, reviews of it and content on it because they didn't want to
encourage to
going
it.
To see it. And all that for a movie that wasn't that good. In fact, I'm looking at my top movies, and by and large, the ones that were supposed to go to streaming were better than the ones that managed to creepily sneak their way back into cinemas. You know, so what did they lose? What did you lose, Hollywood? Probably not a lot, because you still made money. I guess, but
Another funny thing that Quiet Place Part Two is the first film I remember being delayed. It was the week of its release, and they said, "Oh, we'll chuck it in September. Things will be fine then." And now it's been delayed for almost a full year from its initial release date to April 23rd next year, or this year, sorry. But on September 4th, we got the first live action film from Charlie Kaufman in over a decade with I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Charlie Kaufman's one of my favorite writers, favorite directors. He's only directed a couple of films, but I love his writing, and so I was very excited to get a new film from him. And this was on my most anticipated for the year, and it's my second favorite film of the year after Hamilton.
Nice. I've got it at number five. I thought this was great, man. It's a rare case of a movie I don't understand at all, but I still really enjoy it. It's so fucking atmospheric. It's such a juicy, tasty movie because it's so creepy and interesting and fun. The acting in it is great. The writing is great. The directing is great. I think it's Charlie Kaufman's. I think it's the best film he's directed. I don't know if it's the best film he's written.
But. Yeah, sure. It's because like it's only really got four actors in it. Jesse Plemons, David Thewlis, Toni Collette. No, is it Toni Collette?
Yes.
Yeah, and Jesse Buckley.
All like four of the best actors working in TV.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Now they all star in a movie together. Actually, three out of those four have been in seasons of Fargo as well. Different seasons, even, because Jesse Plemons is in season two, David Thewlis is in season three, and Jesse Buckley is in season four.
Yeah,
which I finished recently.
Congratulations. It is a very creeps up on you, and it's one of those films that you're like, at the start of it, you're like, oh, something's a little off about this, and then you're like, but maybe it's just me, or maybe it's a film, or maybe I noticed a mistake, and then midway through the film, you're like, something's definitely off about this. And then at the end of the film, you're like, oh, okay. There's a lot off about the film.
And just, you know, we probably won't talk spoilers, because this is a go and watch it kind of film if you haven't seen it. Jeremy, you didn't see it?
No, but it was really funny because I got the sense, I saw your letterbox like rankings of this film, and then I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And then I like literally had not seen anything about it. And then I was at a barbecue and I heard two of my friends go like, oh my God, guys, we just watched this awful movie last night. Not watch
it.
It's called I'm Thinking of Ending Things. And then someone goes, oh my God, I watched that as well. It's so shit. What even is about that movie? And like this whole group just like piled on how terrible they thought this movie. And I was like, you guys are obviously not Charlie Kaufman fans, so probably not for you.
May I inquire, Jeremy, as to the normie levels of this friend group?
Oh, that's why I said you guys are probably not Charlie Kaufman fans. Yeah.
It is
unabashedly, this is a filmies movie. This is
100%.
It's the kind of film that I can't be bothered defending. If like someone would go, oh fuck, I watched that, it was so shit, eh? I'd be like, yeah, man.
It's art. When it comes down to a question of art, it's like either you looked at that painting and saw something in it, or you didn't.
Yeah.
And that you can't argue with that. It's just you don't get what the artist was doing. And that's fine. But you'll probably judge the person who doesn't get it.
This is a classic film, and again, I spoke about this a few times there. It sucks that it's getting released on Netflix because the wrong people are watching it. Because people go, oh, well, I enjoyed Holiday and I enjoyed The Old Guard.
And Christmas Chronicles 2.
Christmas Chronicles 2. I'll chuck on I'm Thinking of Anything, because Netflix movies tend to be good, right? You know,
Adam Sandler.
Operation Christmas Drop. What was the Falling in Love? I'll put on I'm Thinking of Anything. It sounds like a romantic drama. And then you watch these films that are like these incredible filmmakers, or you know, like Martin Scorsese doing something different with The Irishman. You go, oh, cool, I love Goodfellas. Oh, I'm Kiefer, shoot him up. And no, it's like he's actually really doing something different. Marriage Story is a classic example of like, no, this is not like a... It's more intelligent than well, you're expecting just scrolling through a Netflix
quotes,
movie.
Netflix movie. Yeah. It's a film.
It's the Criterion collection. It's in the Criterion collection. Like that's all you need to know about Marriage Story. Hey, let's, you know, gotta say it, best title of the year, probably. I'm thinking of ending things. I think that's such a compelling title. Also, best trailer of the year. I watched the trailer before the film. Richard, you didn't. Yeah, yeah. And
because I was like, I'm going to watch it. I don't need to be convinced.
Jeremy, you should watch the trailer if you're not going to watch the film because it's very fun. And I can't remember if it does this in the movie or not, but in the trailer at least, it might be in the movie as well, the line "I'm thinking of ending things" is said through voiceover quite a few times. Every time it's said, it's cut off one word earlier. So, like, the first time you hear it, it's like, I'm thinking of ending things. And the second time, it's like, I'm thinking of ending... And then they get interrupted, and it's, I'm thinking of... And, you know, like, it does that all the way through the trailer, and I think through the film, and it's a really... It really plays with your mind, because the way it... Almost as the opposite of Tenet, the way it plays with dialogue is something I've never heard in a movie before, because you wind up being like...
Because it's all about, like, her voiceovers getting interrupted... It's like she'll be doing voiceover, and he's like, "Did you say something?" And it's like, it's very disconcerting because it opens with like a 30-minute just car ride, but it's very the dialogue's very gripping.
I need to watch it again, man. It's so good. All right, that is part one for you. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Part two will be out next week. So if you liked this episode and you liked this show, if you've never heard it before, please, first of all, weird episode to start on, but also please consider liking and subscribing to Cold Pop Show on all our different platforms. We're on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, as I've said 1,000 times. Where else are we? We're on Patreon, patreon.com/coldpopshow, if you want to donate to us, and of course join our Discord as well. Check out all the stuff in the show notes, and we'll see you next week, and stay tuned for the post credit scene as soon as I stop talking. All right, everybody, we'll see you next time. All right, and back from my outro to the post credit scene.
Hey, I'm back.
And Richard's back. How are you, Richard?
Yeah, good. And Jeremy's back. Oh, yeah, good. It's me, Jeremy.
Sorry for the abrupt ending to that episode, but this is the post-credit scene where if you pay us $5 or more on our Patreon, you get to give us something to talk about at the end of each episode. And today's post-credit scene comes to us from Luke. He asks, what are your favorite couch gags and chalkboard gags in The Simpsons? Richard, what are your favorite couch gags and chalk gags?
Couch gag. I am a fan of Don Hertzfeldt's one. I have some of his work tattooed on my body. He's like, because they got guest animators. And I am very close to getting his Homer Octopus tattooed. Because it's like I currently only have Simpsons or Don Hertzfeldt tattoos, and so it'd be fun to get a combination of the two.
Nice.
So that one I really like. It's funny because Simpsons is the greatest show of all time, and I grew up with it. But the ones that are kind of coming to mind are the later ones where they're kind of being a bit more experimental with them. There's the Guillermo del Toro one. There's a Banksy one. The Rick and Morty one. Wubba Lubba Dub Dub. But like, yeah, because the classic ones are more just like a very quick joke, whereas they kind of became an art form later on. But there's the classic circus one, which is the one where it was the longest one in those kind of first few seasons, and it was used quite a lot. And so they used that when an episode was running short when they needed a few extra seconds on it. But there is one with Freddy and Jason waiting for. It's in the Treehouse of Horror, I think number 10, maybe.
Okay, nice.
Then waiting for the shop. But do you want to do couch kicking? I can do chalkboard.
Well, my favorite is a combination of the two, which is in the 200th episode of The Simpsons. It's a shorter start, and as the family run towards the couch, they actually run into the classroom where Bart is standing there writing, "I will not screw with the opening, with the opening sequence with the opening or something."
Credits, yeah.
Yeah, that, and I'd never seen that before, or at least I didn't remember seeing it, and I thought that was quite funny.
Yeah, and that's Trash of the Titans, I believe, is the 200th episode.
I think so. Yeah.
The couch gag that sticks out to me that really gets me is after Marsha Wallace passed away, who's the voice of Edna Krabappel. There's a couch gag where it's Bart standing in front of the chalkboard. There's only one line written on it, and it says, "We'll really miss you, Mrs. K." And
that's really sweet.
I remember, I think I must have seen a picture of it, or I read that was what it was that week, and I got choked up just like reading it. And then I saw the episode years later, not realizing that would be the episode that it was. And yeah, I got choked up again. It's a very powerful image, and I have a very soft spot for animated tributes to people.
Mm. Yes, we talked about that on the Muppets
episode. We did talk about that on the Muppets episode. But yeah, it's kind of speaking to that.
Yeah, nice.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.